wrapping the kids out of their coats, the way the babies haven't been born.
Welcome to Teacher Besties, a podcast for teachers. I'm Jamie.
And I'm Kelly. On this week's agenda, we will take a look at lunches in Japan. We'll discuss a new ruling by a California judge, which is going to allow for the release of 10 million students, high school students, the data of them, unless they refuse or opt out. And we will also talk about the idea of getting a student teacher and whether or not that is exciting or terrifying or a combination.
Do you want to tell me about your week?
Yeah. Let's see. I think my students are most excited about the fact that we are listening to Serial. And so I have about...
What episode are you guys on?
Five. Of season one, I should clarify. So I'm using it to kind of like teach them listening and speaking stuff, but... Well, one justification, I guess, is that there is a lot of, or there's a significant listening portion on Common Core testing. So there seems to be a little bit more of like a push to do some sort of like listening comprehension in class. But then there was also a teacher about a year ago who wrote like a pretty compelling op-ed for... I think he wrote it on his blog and then it got picked up by Slate and like a few other like major publications wrote about him and how he, instead of teaching Shakespeare, he was teaching Serial and like he had designed all of these lessons. So I'm actually teaching a lot of his material. So,
oh, neat.
Which was kind of cool because he and his wife developed these handouts that go with it, and they're actually really good lessons. And you know, obviously you can kind of like mix and match, pick and choose, but they're really good. But instead of throwing out Shakespeare like he did, I'm actually teaching it concurrently with Othello because I think they have a lot of like thematic, you know, connections. She even, Sarah Koenig even says, like, compares it to a Shakespearean tragedy at one point and says, like, you know, the Moor and his wife. And so my students are really excited about that. Like, they come into class, and even though they're excited about Othello, the first thing they will say is, like, are we watching Serial today? I mean, listening to Serial today? And, you know, so I usually update them when we're going to do Serial so that they have an expectation. But, yeah, it's cool. Like, this week what we did was we listened to the story, and we compared the evidence that was presented in court, like the cell phone evidence, to the testimony of, you know, one of the big players in the show. And I had them plot like the evidence on two maps and then see where the, like whether or not the stories could corroborate one another or if there were, you know, things that were missing there. And the stories are actually, you know, they don't align. If you've listened to the podcast, you know that, but, yeah, so it was cool. I mean, it takes like critical thinking, and it actually gets them questioning a lot of really big idea things about the justice system. And it's, you know, especially being like upper class kids, like 17, 18 years old, they start kind of questioning like the, you know, like sort of the idea that you have when you're 16 of justice of like, oh, only like, you know, bad people go to jail and all of those things. And then they start realizing like, why would this person testify against somebody when it seems like they were in on it? And, oh, maybe they cut a deal and all that stuff. So it brings up a lot of really interesting things to talk about.
I wish you had like if you knew one of the government teachers at your school and you could make it like cross curricular, that would be amazing.
Yeah, that would be really cool. What would you do with that since you've taught government?
Definitely looking at like the judicial system, although the curriculum for government in California is more the federal level. And so I think this is a state case.
Yeah, it's a state
case. And so maybe just looking, at least what I did, and I know you've borrowed the book, it's called We the Students, and it looks at student-centered Supreme Court and federal level cases, mostly about the First, Fourth, and 14th Amendments.
Yeah, that book is amazing.
Yeah, it's like, It's a really great read. I highly recommend it to anyone who likes the Supreme Court. I think Santo's saying hi.
Oh, hi, Santo.
And so I would try to tie it into that, but sadly, I don't teach that course anymore. So I don't, I mean, next year, if you're still at the same site, you should definitely scope out. If you're teaching seniors again, find some government teachers and see.
Yeah, that would definitely be cool, especially because I think, you know, it's high school students that are involved in the case as well. So it really, a lot of the things that the case presents are very relatable to them. Like even when they're going over whether or not, like the plausibility of whether or not the person could have committed the crime, they have to trace the steps of the convicted guy. And they start in a high school hallway when, like, the bell has rung. And you know how long it takes for, like, the kids to clear out. And then, like, how long it takes for them to get out of the parking lot. And as soon as, like, the narrator says that, all of my students were just, like, kind of chuckling with, like, you know, they sort of understood, like, how ridiculous it was to think, oh, yeah, it's just going to be easy for this guy to, like, get out of the parking lot and then go commit this heinous crime and then be back in 20 minutes. So there's a lot of parallels to their lives that they can understand.
That's really enthralling. I wish I had listened to Serial so I could comment more deeply on this, but it makes me nervous to listen to things like that.
I know you're not a true crime lover like myself.
I know. I'm so sorry.
What are you up to?
Well, I've been on break for the past week and this is my last, well, it's Saturday today. So my last 2 days before school starts again, and it was a much needed break. Like so much. I feel really good. I spent a lot of break working on, I wasn't aware that I had to do this, but for that AP class I teach, I had to take practice quizzes and learn how to align myself so I could grade their tests.
This is like via video clips, right?
This is via sample essays and video clips and then rubrics, and it's all online. And it took me, I would say, like 25 hours to sit and do it, which was a lot of time.
That's quite an investment.
That I didn't really plan on spending on that. And it was really hard. Like, really hard.
Calibrating can be difficult. I mean, that's kind of why it's so important, but it's not always fun.
No, it was not fun. Some of the things were interesting. So, like, topic-wise, some of the essays I read and some of the videos watching were awesome. But then some of them were super boring. And, like, I did not know what they were talking about. Like, they used really big science words. And I was like, let's go talk about the education stuff again. But overall,
have some empathy for your English teacher.
I have a lot of empathy for my English teacher friends. But I think hopefully it'll be beneficial, and hopefully a College Board will tell me if I've passed. I hope I did. I guess we'll have to wait and see. Okay, so full disclosure, to be honest, I found this on Reddit. It's a video. It's called School Lunch in Japan, and it's actually put out by an organization called Cafeteria Culture. They have a website, cafeteriaculture.org, and it seems to be some kind of environmental movement that promotes zero waste projects in cafeterias, which in itself is very interesting. But the video is specifically about a fifth grade class in Japan and what they do during lunch. And it's the cutest thing ever.
I mean, it's not just cute. It's
fine.
Like,
it's
totally
amazing.
Inspirational. And like,
okay, let's start by talking about the school garden, because that's where it all begins. They have a garden at this, it's grades 1 through 6 in Japan. And the fifth graders plant potatoes, and it seems that each class is somehow involved in growing some food item. They have permanent cafeteria workers that every single day make from scratch food for all 300 and something of their students.
Oh, it was 700.
Oh, 700. Oh, yeah. Man. So sorry, got that number wrong.
I'm just saying, like, it was 700 plus students that they make lunch for every day.
And then all the students bring a little cup, a toothbrush, chopsticks, a placemat, their own cloth napkins, and a little like a head covering and an apron to wear. Mm-hmm. And that's what they carry in their backpacks in addition to their school books every single day.
They eat in their classroom.
Yes, they do. With the teacher.
Yes, I love that.
And there's a designated 45-minute period to eat lunch.
Yes. Okay, let me just tell you some of the things I loved about this.
Okay.
Okay, one. So there's like 5, 6, 7 kids that are like kind of in charge of like going to get the food, serving the food, taking it into account of how much food is left, whatever. I loved that they talked about like food safety before they went and
handled
the food.
They asked are you sick? Have you been sick in the past few days?
Yeah. And then they all like wash their hands and then put like hand sanitizer on their hands. And they're very careful about how they're handling the food, which I just thought, you know, what a great lesson. Like, you shouldn't be handling food when you're sick.
Yes.
I loved that the kids were so thankful. The video opens with them thanking their teacher for teaching them. And then when they enter the cafeteria, they thank the people there for cooking for them, which I just thought, like, I mean, even if it's just like, you know, a habit for them, like what an important thing for them to learn that you should thank your teacher for teaching you, as opposed to, you know, sort of the way we do it, which is like, you know, the kids kind of are just like entitled and think like, it's your job, you have to show up. And like, you know, it's very rare like that a student will thank you unless they like genuinely are moved by something.
But, true. I would also say that in Japan, everyone thanks you everywhere you go. My husband and I call it like aggressive thanking, that like as you're walking out of the restaurant, every single person who works there is basically screaming thank you at you as you leave.
It's awesome though. I love it.
It really is.
Okay, another thing that I loved was the sense of community that I think eating together in the classroom with your classroom teacher must cultivate, because, like, you could see how genuinely happy the teacher was to meet with them. It was, like, one moment of the day you could see where he could kind of be silly and also have a personality, and it was appropriate.
Absolutely. I guess what I thought of, especially because neither of us have taught elementary school, like, would it be the same in high school? Or...
It's hard to say. I mean, I think it has to do with, like, you know, cultural practices, for one. Like, what do you think about your teachers and adults in general? So, like, do you think of them as, like, authority figures you should respect? Do you think of them as people that are annoying? Or do you think of them as people you fear? Do you think of them as your buddies? Like, we just have very different feelings towards adults when we're teenagers. But also, I don't know. I don't know what it would be like. I think here we tend to think of our lunchtime as, like, a break from work.
Yeah.
And also, like, I don't want to see those people I have to see during the workday, both for adults and teenagers.
Absolutely. Like, people ask to stay in my room during lunch, and I feel bad saying this out loud, but I say, no, this is my time. I'm really sorry. Yeah,
and it absolutely is your time. But then you see kind of the flip side of, like, the community that it builds, which is, you know, it's kind of cool.
It's amazing.
That's kind of cool, too.
What else did you like?
Okay. The other thing that I absolutely loved was, at the end of the video, they talk about how every single day they have a 20-minute cleanup where the kids are, like, all in charge of something, and they're all, like, scrubbing their classroom. Like, some kids are cleaning the floor. Some kids are wiping down the tables. Like, it's not just after lunch cleanup. It's also just, like, let's clean the classroom. And I just thought, like, what amazing lessons. Like, so many. Teaching, like, the practicality of having to clean up. Like, respecting your space.
Could you imagine if we asked people in our school? I feel like all my students would say, we pay someone to do that. We're not going to.
I have had students say, in the snottiest tone ever, that is what a janitor is for. Which is, like, the most disgusting, like, entitlement ever. But it happens all the time with my students. Worse, actually, though, is the way that my campus looks after lunch. The seagulls just like embark upon the campus as if like the birds, like Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds. And it is disgusting. And I mean, I see kids at lunch throw food at each other. I see them throw stuff on the ground and like they have no regard for it. Like, if when I say to them, like, what are you doing? Like, clean that up. It's almost like they're shocked.
Oh, I definitely chase people down and say things. Like, I saw kids throwing apples at each other, and I stood there until they cleaned it up.
Yeah. I mean, I don't generally think that this is a commentary on, like, all American teenage kids. I think sometimes it's because we teach, like, a pretty privileged population of kids that have been cleaned up after for a lot of years.
I think I would agree with that. Also, I don't know about your new school, but our school, or where you taught before, we don't have a proper cafeteria. And so everyone's sitting everywhere and eating. But, like, where I personally went to high school, a normal inside school, not one of these crazy newfangled California schools, we had a cafeteria. Oh, right. And there wasn't as much waste all around. Like, you had to clean up after your table. Otherwise, it was obvious, like, that you mm-hmm. left it there.
So maybe you just even the simple fact that you were indoors in a building that you wouldn't, like, throw stuff
yeah,
like
correct.
That. But, I mean, I don't know. I see kids throw stuff in my classroom. They leave water bottles all over the place and stuff like that. Like, they just don't think, like, oh, I brought this in here. I need to remove it. So I just thought, as a practice, it was a great lesson during the day. And I thought, if you think about what we emphasize in elementary school, like, why wouldn't 20 minutes of cleaning up after yourselves be like a good
I think
lesson,
it would be perfect.
You know? Yeah.
And to give our students some credit, I do have kids that, like, if they see something on the ground in my room, pick it up. Or if somebody has left a water bottle behind, they're like, oh, do you mind if I recycle this? And I'm like, go right ahead. Thank you. Even though it's not yours.
Yeah.
Like, good job.
I also think that a lot of Montessori elementary schools have this lesson built in. Like, I do know that part of the Montessori way is, like one thing is, like, shoe shining.
What? I don't know anything about Montessori.
They learn how to shine their shoes and, like, shine adults'
shoes.
Could
they come
stuff,
do my shoes?
I don't know, but I think all of the teachers at a Montessori school have, like, really nicely shined
really?
Shoes. That's all. I've heard that. And then also, like, that cleaning up and eating together is valued. So perhaps there are many kids that are being taught under the Montessori discipline in the US.
I think that I will be sending my children to Montessori schools. That's awesome.
I love the Montessori model, but I don't know if Sam's going to go there.
Well, if he goes, I will pay him for my shoe shines.
Oh, okay.
Okay, great. Anyway.
So if people want to see that, we'll probably post it on our Tumblr, the video. But then also what was the website
again? It came from cafeteriaculture.org.
Cool.
Oh, wait. Hold on. There's one more thing, which I guess they also recycle, like, amazingly there. Did you remember the part where they were all, like, they spent time to break down their milk cartons and everyone undid them and then a kid washed them? That was my all-time favorite part. Sorry.
Yes. The cleanup and recycling process was very systematic. Like, they talked about breaking the cartons down, washing them, and then they would, like, dry them in a special part of the classroom for a day. And then that kid was also in charge of moving them down to the recycling area.
It was beautiful. Good job.
Loved it.
Japan.
This week, a California judge has ruled that a small parent-run nonprofit that is currently, like, basically suing the Department of Education in California for the rights of disabled children. This judge has decided to allow them to see the data for 10 million California.
And that data
students.
Includes name, social security number, address, mental and physical assessments of children. And if you've attended a California public school since January of 2008, then that includes you.
Yeah, so I guess the association that is, like, involved in this lawsuit is the Morgan Hill Concerned Parents Association.
Yes, which is part of the larger of the California Concerned Parents Association.
Right, and I guess they represent students with disabilities statewide, and are part of a lawsuit where they were basically looking to see, like, whether or not students with those disabilities were actually getting the accommodations that were mandated.
Or not even that, but they're looking to see if it's equitable compared to their peers. Like, are they getting the same free and public education as their peers without disabilities? Or are there, like, larger numbers of instances, for example, of African-American students included in special day classes versus white students who aren't? Those kind of things they're looking for. And so the issue that I understood from reading this is that the CDE thinks that, like, just handing over the data and the percentages to the Parents Association is enough, but the Parents Association are saying, no, we want to do our own data and calculations.
Yeah, so this judge basically said, yes, you can get all the data, and has... Am I using the term right, that, like, they've subpoenaed
yes.
these districts to, like, get the information? And that as a result, parents basically have 60 days to opt out and to, like, resubmit some sort of form that says, no, I am refusing my child's data to be released. I don't want that out there. But, you know, the thing that this brought up for me was because – I actually got the email for my district informing parents of this lawsuit and that their child's data would be released. But how many kids that are not currently enrolled in public school and that went to school after January 2008, like, probably are not going to be aware of this? Like, that's whose data is going to go without anybody.
Well, okay. Consenting. So to be fair, according to the judge and USA Today, which is where this article came from, only 10 people associated with this Concerned Parents Association are going to have access to the data. But you never know.
Right.
And,
yeah.
like, why do they actually need social security numbers of students? I don't really think that data needs to be released.
Yeah, social security numbers is kind of where I draw the line. Like, it seems like, couldn't you do it based... Couldn't you aggregate the same amount of data that they need just from, like, race, test scores, and, you know, IEP information, those kinds of things without releasing the social security
as I would think, but
well?
I don't know.
So, I mean, I don't know. I don't have a ton to say about it other than you're right that on the one hand, probably it's harmless because 10 people are going to see it, they're going to aggregate the data, they're going to use it in their case, and then they are supposed to destroy it. On the other hand, it just seems
unnecessary.
Like, I'm so surprised, actually, that this judge, like, granted this sort of sweeping, you know, just like, yes, we're going to allow, it's basically, what is it? How many
yeah.
students? 6.2
million
6.2
students. Million.
the data of 6.2 million students plus their social security is to be released to this group, which is very shocking. The other thing I thought of is the students or the parents who are going to opt their student out. Like, what is that?
I know. That's what I was thinking. Cause I feel like the informed parents are like where, at least where we teach, those parents would definitely be in the know. I would opt my child out. I would opt out of that too. I don't think it's necessary.
Well, and also, what's that going to do? It's going to change the data set to be students that are, you know, probably in a disadvantaged community. And so, I don't know. It just seems like that could really mess with the
true
validity of it.
Maybe there is really something not right and compelling going on that the judge thinks that, yes, this data analysis is necessary. I don't know. I guess we'll have to stay tuned and find out.
Because I think students in California, their parents
April 1st.
Have until April 1st to opt out. So, all right. Well, we'll
good luck, students. I'm glad my social security number is safe. That sounded mean. Sorry.
A teacher that I know posted this blog post in her feed written by another teacher. Called I'm getting a student teacher and I'm scared I'll break her. And that, like, headline alone, I was like, oh, I have to know what this is about. It kind of boiled down to this writer who I have to say, like, there were times where I was like, you're not
agreed,
really that
but that's
funny.
Okay.
But, that's okay. But she basically said that, like, you know, she's worried that, like, it's a hard job, and that when she was a student teacher, she often felt that her mentor teacher communicated to her that she was doing a bad job, and that the reason why the job was so hard was because she wasn't doing it right, and that, like, the takeaway at the end was that she was hoping to communicate to her student teacher that the job is really, really difficult, but it's not necessarily because you're not doing your best or that you're not doing it right. It's just a hard job.
Do you want to talk about two things? Perhaps our own student teaching experiences, and then whether or not you would want a student teacher?
Absolutely. So when I was a student teacher, I was not 21 as the person that she's assuming will be in this story. I was 25, I think, and I had already, I'd been a few years out of college. I had interned at several, like, major magazine publications and had explored another career path before laughably thinking I could go into teaching and freelance.
Well, duh, what's wrong with you?
Then I realized while I was teaching, oh, this is actually really hard and completely consuming. But so I started student teaching. I had already subbed for like an entire year. So I had already seen sort of like the worst of students. I student taught at a pretty diverse school where, I don't know, I would say that probably 60% of the kids are like socioeconomically disadvantaged. Probably a pretty large Latino population, with the second biggest population being white. And so I had like a very diverse in terms of ability level, group. I taught freshmen. Actually, I taught a class of freshmen English language learners and a class of seniors. So almost the entire opposite of the spectrum at this school, because the seniors at this school were sort of like survivors. You know, it was like they had like managed to navigate a school that a lot of kids didn't do well in and like come out on top. My mentor teacher was a woman who was the swim coach, and like my impressions of her was that she wanted a student teacher so that she didn't have to teach two of her five classes. She spent a lot of time buying swim gear on the computer while I was teaching. She did not watch my lessons very often. She just left the room. On the one hand, I was a very capable student teacher. I was always prepared. I taught new and interesting things. Like, I was doing my best. And I wasn't one of those student teachers that came in, watched the teacher before me do it, and then do the same exact thing. And I also had a really amazing advisor. So, like, in my program, you would also have a retired teacher from that district that was awesome. And that woman is really what like got me through. Like, she was basically my mentor teacher. But I think I had the experience that a lot of people have where, like, instead of learning from this amazing teacher, you sort of learned kind of what not to do from a mediocre teacher, but also like just sort of hit the ground running because you didn't have anyone to rely on.
I think I had a little bit of a different experience. I had two master teachers. They were both men who were in their late 40s. They're both very nice, and you know me well, and internet, I guess you know me too. I have a bit of a strong personality. And so they pretty much gave me free rein to do whatever I wanted. If I asked for help, I got it, but they didn't actively offer as much help. But again, I wasn't really looking for it. I just wanted to know, like, if I had messed up royally, like, this is what I did wrong. I didn't need someone to, like, double check my lesson plans and make sure that, like, my objective was aligned with my outcome. I was capable of doing that on my own, but I liked it. I think that if I would have had a really strong and organized person, that it might not have been a good match for me. Like, I appreciated the free reign.
I would agree. I mean, I feel like, looking at it from the reverse perspective now, like, if I had a student teacher, I know a lot of teachers that are great teachers, but where they basically require their student teacher to like give them their lesson plans really far in advance and approve them and all of those things. I almost kind of think I would be a little more like, you know, I expect you to teach quality lessons. Like I expect you to do your best and I expect you to be prepared the moment they walk in, and then like evaluate them almost as if like I was,
yeah,
you know, just observing, like, cause I just think sometimes the pre-prep stuff like really messes with them, and that's not what the
day
is going to be like on the job. They're going to be expected to have it ready. So, and also like, guess what? If you're not prepared, I'm not going to save you. Like you're going to learn how hard it is to fall on your face if you're not ready. Cause that's really the terrifying thing about being a teacher is like, they don't stop coming in. And if you're not ready, you're, you know, it's worse for you.
That's so true. Well, I actually, at the end of last year, I got an email asking if I wanted a student teacher, and I replied yes. I was very excited to meet a little version of me, obviously, because that's totally who I was going to get. But then no one followed up, and I don't have one, so I'm kind of disappointed. I thought that this might be the perfect year for me to do it, considering I have four sections of the freshman class, And not that I want someone to make my photocopies or do my work for me, but it probably would have been a great opportunity for them to be like, oh, I see her doing this. I'm going to copy her and do it that way. And like if somebody had... Yeah.
I was just thinking that the hardest thing I think about like being a mentor teacher would be if you just had an absolutely terrible student teacher, which I have definitely heard the horror stories of having student teachers that just come in completely unprepared, or the kid or the student teacher that like never ever, like not a single time teaches their own lesson. They just literally care exactly what you do.
What I was going to say is that if someone got hold of my files and saw how organized and it was, that I think that anyone would be set to teach, like especially my content. Like they would be good to go.
Another thing I would say that I thought was really beneficial from my student teaching days was actually the woman I was talking to you about that was my advisor, who was amazing. She gave me such good emotional support, and like she still today is a contact that I really rely on and who like continues to make me feel like I'm doing the right profession and like that I'm good at it. And coming from someone who I know was an amazing teacher and like was a 30-year teacher, that feels really awesome good a lot of the time. And yeah, I mean, I still remember the day when I was student teaching, like the first day that I like broke down after class and was crying because I had like really, really terrible students who probably did not have great home lives, but they were taking it out on me. And I just remember her telling me like it was not your fault. Like, you know, it broke down and yes, you would need to find solutions and you'd need to figure out how to deal with it. But like, it wasn't because you failed, you know,
something. So I really liked my equivalent of that person that you had. She was great. But even better than that, there were four other student teachers from my credentialing program at the same site as me. And they were really great. And no one else was in the history department, but I remember third and fourth period, we used to all go sit in the library together and do all our homework for the program. Yeah. Then lesson plan together. And it was kind of perfect.
You know what I do have to say is that like for all of the times where people complain about being a teacher, so teaching two classes, that's what I did for a semester, was I taught two classes, two separate preps, and then going to school at night and doing all of the work and all of that. Like I have to say, like it was 100% easier than being a full-time teacher. Like whenever they say like that is really, really difficult, I'm like, nope, being a full-time teacher
I think
is
about
way
my first
harder
year teaching, and often I'm like, how did I do that? Because that was the year that I was getting my alternative credential in English, finishing my master's, and then teaching full time.
I did my first year at a really, really challenging school with an extremely challenging population where you basically worked 40 hours just in the classroom, and then you did like 20 or 30 hours a week outside for like meetings and planning and stuff like that. And I did BITSA that year. And I say the exact same thing. Like, I don't know how I survived it. And I also, I think, like, there is no way I could have ever stayed at that school and maintained
any,
like,
semblance of a personal life. Yeah.
Any sort of social life. Right. I mean, I completely, myself and, like, everybody else that I knew that worked at that school that year, we just were like, that's all we did.
I'm glad you made it past that.
Made it past. And also, I think the best thing that that woman says in her article, too, was, like, if you're a student teacher and you're questioning yourself and whether or not you're doing a good job, one, you probably are doing your best if you're actually thinking about it like that. And two, like, she says after 10 years, she does the exact same thing. And I think we can both say that after, you know, six years, we do the exact same thing. And I just think, like, as much as you probably don't want to admit it, I think that's just teaching. Like, it's just your life.
It is. Moments one by one. I guess that's how the future's done.
You can find us at teacherbestiespodcast.tumblr.com. You can find us on iTunes by searching Teacher Besties. And you can email us with any questions or comments.